Coming to you from the ancestral territory of the Anishinaabe and the area inhabited by the Mississaugas of the New Credit First Nation, this is Earth Matters. I'm your host, Lawson Hunter. Earth Matters examines the impacts we have on the environment and the natural world around us, seeking solutions, reporting on news and events, presenting positive alternatives, and highlighting the steps others are taking. We hope to inspire you to join the many others who are working to preserve and protect a healthy planet. I'm speaking with Tom Llewellyn from Shareable. He's Strategic Partnerships Director of Shareable. Welcome to Earth Matters again, Tom. It's been a little over a year since we last spoke, and Shareable, the organization, the nonprofit organization based in the U.S., has been very, very busy. I'm hoping we can talk about a number of different programs that Shareable has been up to over the past year. So where do you want to start? What are big things going on at Shareable?
Yeah, well, just to begin, thanks for having me back on the show. It was great being on about a year and a half ago and talking about sharing cities and kind of our general work at Shareable to empower the world to share. And I'm happy to be back and talk a little bit more about one of our newer projects that we really got going last fall, that's focusing on disasters and specifically looking at the ways that communities come together during those disasters to provide mutual aid and create an overall kind of cultural care to support each other. And it's one of the things that is pretty universal all over the world. When disaster strikes, the first impetus of people is to help their neighbors, to take off their shirts, off their back, basically to give to somebody else when they're in need, rather than what we often see is people pushing people away, putting up walls, all that sort of thing that's being projected in the media. So we really wanted to start a project that could explore examples of this to better help prepare other communities that might be facing disasters in the future.
Tell me more about the response. You've got a podcast, you've got a film, titled The Response. Tell me about those two things.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, we started this project to kind of explore these remarkable communities that come together in the aftermath of disasters. And we really thought about it as a multimedia project from the beginning. And the project itself actually was birthed from a kind of nonprofit accelerator program, but there's about 25 different organizations that are part of it called the Thriving Resilient Communities Collaboratory. And this project came together as a result of a partnership between Shareable, Post Carbon Institute, Transition US, and New Stories. And we all kind of came together and wanted to figure out what a unique offering would be from our four organizations. And so we started brainstorming and we kind of split into two sets, where Post Carbon Institute and Shareable started working on the response, and Transition US and New Stories started to, they created a project cohort to help community groups start new resilience initiatives. And so these projects were designed to work in concert. And as the kind of media side of the response has continued to evolve, we started it as a podcast. And in the first season, we ended up just doing three episodes that were all basically documentaries about a different disaster. So in the first season, we looked at New York City after Hurricane Sandy, Puerto Rico after Hurricane Maria, and Northern California after the 2017 Tubbs fire. And every episode is basically created to look at a disaster that's happened, not just in the last few weeks or that's emerging right now, but something that's happened, at least a year beforehand, with the idea of kind of going back to that disaster, revisiting that disaster, to see what the people there learned, what were some of the outcomes that came up from the disaster. You know, how have communities come together? Are there lasting effects? You know, is there some amount of systems change that's occurred as a result of the organizing that emerged from as a result of that disaster? And so that's kind of the way the podcast looks. And we were fortunate enough to work with a really great film director and cinematographer for our Puerto Rico episode. And simultaneously, as we were making the podcast, we were also able to film the documentary, which now has taken us another year in post to release, but has just come out in the last week. And so those are the two primary components of the project.
The film is called, or subtitled, How Puerto Ricans Are Restoring Power to the People. And you're not just talking about electricity. What kind of power are you talking about there?
Yeah, we're really talking about civic power more than electricity itself. And, you know, there are parts of Puerto Rico that even now have not had electricity restored. But in the wake of Hurricane Maria, there was some amazing community organizing projects and greater resilience projects that emerged. And in the film specifically, we look at the mutual aid centers that came up, starting in Caguas and spread to 10 other different areas across Puerto Rico. There's a lot of more even informal ones set up as well. And these centers were created really because of the dire need to feed people at first. Once the electricity went out and a lot of people's homes were destroyed, there was no physical way of cooking, of providing sustenance. And as many of your listeners will know, the response from the U.S. government has been very slow and inadequate at best. And so the people of Puerto Rico really had to come together very quickly to meet their own needs. And so community kitchens were established, and that's where this first center in Caguas first was there, and they were feeding up to 600 people a day out of a community center. And very quickly, they realized that there was a lot of other needs that the community needed to have met in addition to food. And you know, the ability to process some of the collective trauma that had occurred as a result of the storm. And so they started putting on acupuncture clinics and treating, you know, people's back injuries and everything else. And it was a very participatory project. So it was one of the kind of things where, you know, it was open for people to bring ideas, to bring new ways of supporting their neighbors, but also was completely dependent on people in the community coming to help serve the food, prepare the food, you know, get trained in acupuncture. And then from there, these centers became really important places for community organizing in general. As the kind of storm passed away, there was what often happens during disasters is there is a culture of opportunists that come in, and we refer to it as disaster capitalism. Naomi Klein wrote an excellent book all about it called The Shock Doctrine. And there was this big push to sell off a lot of the public infrastructure, to privatize the schools and the electric and the water system and everything else basically that could be sold to the highest bidder. And these centers became important places for the community to come together to organize against that wholesale of the commons. And so we really try to dive into a lot of the different aspects that of what was happening at those centers and what was happening in Puerto Rico in the year after Hurricane Maria. Now, and so all of our filming took place last summer. So now it's 2 years, and we did a little bit of focusing, kind of looking on what's happened since then, and with the kind of unprecedented political organizing and general strike that took place last month, or starting in July, and with the resignation of their governor on the 24th of July as well. So the film kind of looks at kind of that kind of arc for over the last 2 years.
Sounds like you could add resistance to the resilience statement. And obviously this ties in very much with what Shareable is about, and the sharing economy, sharing cities, sharing resources amongst each other, and not waiting for Big Brother or government or some agency to come along and save the day. This, you're talking grassroots. These are your neighbors, the people, and in many cases, the people you've never met before, but for the first time, you're getting to understand who they are and what strengths they have, and in turn, turning around and saying, well, if you can do this, I can do that, and together we can achieve a lot more than if we do it separately or wait for someone else.
And absolutely. I think it takes the community coming together to be better prepared. And I'm going to talk about a guide that we've created to kind of complement the film to help communities do some of this organizing work. But also, you know, there's also a need to not let the government off the hook. I think that we really need more community and government partnerships. And there was, you know, it's been shown again and again that the power of communities to come together to meet each other's needs. And in many cases, it's much more effective than the government. One of our most recent episode of The Response that just came out yesterday actually looks at the 2017 Puebla earthquake in Mexico City and around in Mexico, but we focus in on specifically in Mexico City. And we looked at kind of initiative that emerged after the earthquake called Verificado 19S. And Verificado was set up to verify the needs of, you know, whether or not a building was actually collapsed, whether or not there was actually somebody there trapped, because there was so much misinformation that was going on after the earthquake. And it got to the point where, you know, there's one kind of emblematic story of Ava Sofia, where there was supposedly a girl was trapped in a school, and all of this support rallied. International relief groups showed up. The government was focused on there. There was 24 hours news cycle, and it after a while it became clear that Ava Sofia never existed, and that it was all, you know, it's there's still questions about whether or not somebody had manufactured this girl to for their own purposes. At what point in time the government actually knew and the media knew that there was nobody there trapped, but they continued the narrative until they could figure out a way to spin it, because so many resources had been focused on that area. But Verificado came together because of this. And so very quickly they became more effective at sussing out where relief support was needed than the Mexican government. And so they were, you know, sending not one but two people to verify each location before they would send supplies and resources. And after a while, the government was coming to them, was saying, hey, please tell us where we need to go. Like, you clearly have a better idea of what's needed. And that's the kind of partnership that didn't take place in the same way in New York after Hurricane Sandy, where the Rockaways were really devastated area of New York, and Occupy Sandy, you know, which came out of the Occupy movement, came in and did some amazing organizing. But at the same time, the Red Cross and FEMA were told, you know, workers for the Red Cross and FEMA were told specifically not to work or support the grassroots organizers. And so we're oftentimes working across purposes. There was folks that were working for both those institutions, for FEMA and for Red Cross, which were circumventing their orders and were offering support as they could. But then coming out of that, when FEMA wrote up their report, they said, you know, actually, we kind of messed up here. And really, we should be supporting these grassroots groups, because the truth is, and this also was echoed in the report that came out after Hurricane Maria, that FEMA is, they are completely unprepared to meet the amount of the need that's coming as a result of the amount of disasters that we're now facing. The amount of disasters have really picked up in the last decade. Over the course since 1980, there's been an average of about six major disasters per year. These are, you know, disaster causing at least $1 billion or more worth of damages. In the year 2017, there was in the United States alone, there was 16 of these disasters that left a death toll in the thousands and over $300 billion in damages. And these agencies just aren't set up to be able, you know, even in the best case scenario, even with the best of intentions, even with all the resources they have, are not set up to deal with disasters like that, and that we're going to be continuing to face moving forward.
Is this a North-South thing? Is this the fact that North Americans are so reliant on government or so focused on being individuals that they reject the whole idea that a neighborhood can come together and solve a problem a lot easier than a bureaucracy?
I don't really think that it is. I think that it's, as I mentioned kind of earlier, there's it's human nature to help each other. And I think that we have for a long time relied on our institutions in a way that maybe other countries haven't, although, you know, many other countries have much more robust institutions than we have in North America. But there is kind of, you might be right, there may be some sort of a cultural thing there. At the same time, yeah, these disasters are just hitting everywhere around the world, you know, and it's not just, you know, there's a lot of media coverage of the disaster in the United States, especially in the U.S. and in North America. I remember during Hurricane Harvey across the Texas and the Southwest, there was constant coverage of what was going on there, and it was incredibly destructive and worthy of that coverage. But at the same time, there was the greatest flooding, I think, to ever hit kind of India and Bangladesh. Like nearly half the country of Bangladesh was underwater at that point in time. The death toll was you know, in the thousands, far more than as a result of Hurricane Harvey, but got very little news coverage. And that story, actually, that juxtaposition between those disasters is one of the things that really inspired me to want to tell these stories in this way, to be able to cover kind of some of the underreported disasters from around the world, and really to learn from them as much as we can. And so as we've done this film and the podcast now, we wanted to create a tool really to support communities to be able to be better organized before a disaster strikes. And so we've been working with a kind of service designer and also a kind of a writer of guides, Danny Spitzberg, to put together this guide to creating resilience hubs, to basically turning existing community spaces, and this could be a church or a school or an art gallery, you know, a co-working space, you know, a large co-housing or anything else like that, into any of our existing community spaces into resilience hubs. And so the guide kind of goes through six different examples of different communities from around the world and the way that they've worked through a disaster and what they've created to support their community moving forward, as well as kind of six steps towards transitioning an existing space into a space for resilience.
What's the name of that guide, and how can people find out how to get a hold of it?
I've got the guide right here in my hand, which can make a little noise, but it's called The Resilience We Want, A Guide to Making Your Community Space into a Hub for Local Resilience and Mutual Aid. And people can find that at shareable.net. It's right now, it's the feature story. And it's, as I mentioned before, it's set up to complement the film of the response. And what we are imagining is that groups are going to be coming together to watch the film together, and then after watching the film, to work through the guide, to go through those steps and to imagine the space that they might be in right then watching that film. And so for the response, anybody can watch the trailer is up on YouTube and it's on shareable.net as well. But the film is not going to be coming out for another month, except for community screenings. And so far, we've actually already received interest from 28 people, I think on four different continents, to host these community screenings and discussions. And so it's a free thing. Anybody can sign up if they want to host a film screening publicly, or if they want to just host one in their home and bring their friends and family together and not make it a public event. We have a whole guide to help people put on these screenings as well.
Mm-hmm. So in the few minutes we have left, let's turn to Shareable, the larger organization. There are a number of different themes that you work with: housing, mobility, food, work, energy, land, waste, water, technology, finance, governance. I'm assuming that you've got reports or podcasts or some sort of documents that people can turn to find out more about how the collective use of people can be a strength in those areas. Am I correct there?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, we've got a lot of resources. Actually, I think to date at shareable.net, we just moved over to a new website and we discovered that we've published over 4,000 stories in the last decade about the ways that communities are coming together to share. And, you know, over a large swath of topics, we've also produced about 300 how-to guides for anybody to start a tool library or a time bank or, you know, how to share a chicken. And so we've got those resources. And then, you know, you mentioned some of our key areas of focus around housing, mobility, food, work, energy. It goes on. And last year when I came on the show, we just released our new book, Sharing Cities, Activating the Urban Commons, which looks at kind of 11 of these different core city sectors, as we mentioned, through both the kind of community lens, looking at kind of nonprofit initiatives and some businesses to kind of meet those city needs. And then also from the policy side, specifically looking at the ways that cities around the world are empowering their citizens to participate in the provisioning of those core city goods. And so that book, Sharing Cities, is also available on our website as a free download. We recently just released a new book as well that looks at the kind of community solutions to the global loneliness epidemic. And we've done a whole series are looking at loneliness and social isolation and you know, one, kind of how that's affecting our physical health, but two, how that's affecting both our mental and really our civic health, and how this kind of global epidemic of social isolation and loneliness is really contributing towards a greater civic disconnection, which is kind of opening the field for so much division around policy and this rise of the alt-right all over the world. We're seeing, you know, not just in the United States and maybe in Canada. I'm not quite sure how much it's happening there, but really there's this authoritarianism rising globally right now, which is really scary. And I think a lot of it does root down to a fear of others and a lack of connection with others. So we've got this community solutions to how we reduce that, how we break down those barriers, looking at the ways that people are actively finding a way to support each other in that way and to open up dialogues that might otherwise be closed.
And Shareable's also got a series of events happening. I know one Sharing City Summit in Sweden in October. So obviously you're a global entity. What other events do you have coming up?
Yeah, so I mean, one of the big things is there's going to, like I mentioned, is that there's going to be this kind of global distributed film tour where, and we did this with the book as well, where we had over 30 events globally of people kind of having communication conversations and kind of self-organizing events around the book. And we're doing the same thing with the film. And so over the course of the next 2 weeks, we're going to be announcing the first round of screenings. And all told, we're going to have probably about over 30 film screenings globally that people can come and be a part of. And we're actively recruiting more hosts as well. So, you know, with a little luck, we'll make it to 50 by the end of the year. if some of your listeners jump in and decide they want to host one as well.
And final question, how do you get your funding? Where do you get your funding from, and what kind of support do you look for?
Yeah, so we are definitely a reader, listener, supported nonprofit. That's been a pretty key part of our funding, comes from our readers and general supporters. We're also fortunate to get a large grant from a foundation that helps to cover our operational costs, which is something that most nonprofits do not have. And then in addition to that, it's kind of a mix of a certain a small amount of sponsorships. The Response Project has been primarily funded by grants from four different organizations, Shift Foundation, Threshold, Abundant Earth, and the Gorilla Foundation have all come in and seen the value of and the need for this project. And then we also get a certain amount of money from producing events and doing speaking and bringing our talks around. So, you know, if anybody wants to learn more about how to support us, they can find out at shareable.net or to book us. And then we also provide a number of services to kind of help communities to share.
All right. Thank you very much. I've been speaking with Tom Llewellyn, Strategic Partnerships Director with Shareable, and your motto is People-Powered Solutions for the Common Good. Thanks again for joining us on Earth Matters.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me.
Lawson Hunter here, host and producer of Earth Matters. I wanted to thank all the listeners of Earth Matters for your continuing support. As always, please feel free to send us your comments, suggestions, and thoughts on topics and people we should look at for future programs. Email us at earthmatters@newsandcomment.com. News, A-N-D, comment.com.